Kultur denken. Der Podcast des IFK. Liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen zum IFK-Podcast. Mein Name ist Martin Gasterner. In der heutigen Sendung widmen wir uns einem faszinierenden Thema an der Schnittstelle von Archäologie, Linguistik und Kognitionswissenschaft. Im Folgenden hören Sie ein Gespräch mit Professor Silvia Ferrara, einer renommierten Expertin für Archäologie und klassische Philologie, die an der Universität Bologna lehrt. Ihr zentrales Forschungsgebiet, die Entstehung der Schrift, bezeichnet sie gerne als »The messiest beginning of them all«. Der Schwerpunkt unseres Gesprächs liegt auf der prähistorischen Kunst, insbesondere den Höhlenmalereien Frankreichs, an denen Silvia die tiefgreifende Bedeutung für die kognitive Entwicklung des Menschen zeigen kann. Silvia Ferrara legt dar, wie diese frühen Kunstformen, oft religiös motiviert charakterisiert und beschrieben wurden, tatsächlich aber als hochentwickelte Kommunikationsmittel fungierten und den Grundstein für die Entwicklung der Schrift legten. Im Verlauf des Gesprächs werden wir die sogenannten Messy Beginnings der menschlichen Kommunikation erkunden und erfahren, wie diese frühen künstlerischen Ausdrucksformen unsere visuellen und kognitiven Präferenzen geprägt haben. Silvia Ferrara betont die Notwendigkeit eines interdisziplinären Forschungsansatzes, um die vielschichtigen Bedeutungen dieser frühen kommunikativen Versuche zu entschlüsseln. Abschließend werfen wir dann noch einen Blick in die Zukunft und diskutieren die mögliche Rolle der Schrift in einer zunehmend von Technologie geprägten Welt. Wir werden erörtern, wie die potenzielle Revolutionierung unserer Kommunikationsmittel durch künstliche Intelligenz das direkte Erbe jener kreativen und ungeordneten Anfänge darstellt, die wir in den prähistorischen Höhlenmalereien beobachten können. Das folgende Gespräch haben wir in englischer Sprache geführt. Ich wünsche Ihnen ein interessantes Gespräch und viel Vergnügen beim Zuhören.
Because we have to be in here.
Yeah, of course.
We are in an artwork. We're sitting here and in a cave and should be inspired like you were inspired by caves you visited. How many caves have you visited?
Not that many. There
you
are
haven't?
Not so many visitable caves. Yeah. The one that impressed me the most is in Pêche-Mel, which is a province, the Lot province in France, and it dates to 28,000 years ago. And you go down this flight of stairs all the way down. I think it's 15 meters. And you are enveloped into this darkness and very few lights are on. We had a guide, but it was the moment that I stepped in there, I was really entranced. So I could quite, you know, maybe it's just a suggestion. Maybe it's just I was impressed by everything that I had studied, but I was kind of like, you know, led away into a different dimension, whereby time and space were just notions. And I was sucked in to this vacuum without time nor space. And an hour just felt like a minute. It was very odd, very estranged.
Was this a short time ago?
Or? Yeah, this was before the pandemic.
And you had to have permission to go there because it's...
No, it's visitable. It was as easy as that. It was as easy as that. And then in order to see other caves, you have to have permission. But this was the one that impressed me the most, to be so close to things that are not represented elsewhere, like a couple of horses that were so precisely drawn. They were the representation of physical animals of a species of horses that's got little dots, like the dotted horse, that was actually a species that was present 28,000 years ago in that region. And the specificity, the precision, the accuracy by which it was drawn was just incredible. And to imagine people back then representing this in such accuracy without having the physical animal in front of them, in the darkness, being lit by just very small lamps made of like animal fat, and fighting against the lack of oxygen, because you really feel like you've been deprived of any sensory feeling, any sensory interface with the world as we know, with the outside world. It's just, it was incredible. To assume that they could do this with such precision, drawing from the actual nooks and crannies of the rock itself, and being inspired by the shapes of the rocks that were almost suggesting what profiles and what contours to draw. That was, you know, how could they call this primitive? Primitive art. It's just, anything about this definition rang counter to my interpretation. There was nothing primitive about it, nor did I think it was just art. I think there were the specifics of a precise message, a precise code being transmitted to the people that could understand it by the people that drew this, that was too accurate and too precise to be just art. You know, art is open to interpretation. There's the arbitrary conception of wanting to represent symbols and abstraction that need a lot of context to be explained, you know? I need to, in order to interpret precisely a biblical scene drawn by Raffaello, drawn by Caravaggio, I need the context. I need many words to accompany it.
And the codes, yes.
And the codes. I need to decipher it through history. Whereas here, I saw the specificities of a thing that was clear to the people that understood it precisely as it was, that made me think that it was much too specific to be just art.
You found yourself addressed.
Yes, I thought that there was a cognitive behavior that may not be deciphered by us today, but it was articulate and sequential and ordered and tidy to represent the specificities of a code, the idiosyncrasies of a code, rather than just artistic behavior. The message, in other words, that was being transmitted must have been clear to the people looking at it. And that made me think to all the beautiful images of animals in sequence. There were also, and this happens not just in that cave, it happens all over the Paleolithic world, there were geometric and schematic shapes that you find from contemporary and later times. With Peshmel, we're dealing with 28,000 years ago, but even later and slightly earlier in Chauvet, for instance, 35,000 years ago, you see the same patterns, you see the same geometric shapes being used, which has nothing to do with language coding. This is, we cannot say it's writing, although we can't decipher. We cannot decipher what these signs, what these symbols may mean. But the point being that our brain was already, in Paleolithic times, kicked into action towards preferences, towards shapes that were clearly suggested by the environment that these people were exposed to. And that our brain works in very similar fashions, very similar ways, regardless of where we are, because we're drawn to the simplicity of certain figures and configurations and geometric shapes, whatever they may mean. But we're hitting that same result, which is preferences for certain simple signs, symbols, preferences for representing animals as big entities, because they were exposed to animals much more than they were exposed to other humans, you know, because groups were tiny. And this is why humans tend to be, you know, drawn with sticks, as stick animals, like stick humans, rather than in full profile, because the precious thing was the animal, the representation of animals. And And this is something that has never left us. Think about the ways in which we represent animals now, Disney, and we have an aptitude, we have an inclination towards that kind of representation, and that is biological rather than historical or being artistic preference only. I think it's an interface between our brain and the environment that surrounds us. The environment gives us the ingredients to the recipe, and then we select through our visual perception certain shapes that are suggested by the environment, but we filter them. It's not a, you know, we don't represent the world as it is. Yeah. We never do. We filter through several gradients. This is why from Paleolithic time onwards, we've chosen contours, and this is why writing is the way that it is. We need the black on white contrast, and we need lines. Lines are the quintessential representational preference because it gives us that immediate focus, that immediate attention. The animal drawn by a line, all you need is a line, kicks into action and pops up. It becomes a kick to our retina and we recognize the shape instantly. So it's not at all a coincidence that writing looks the way that it does. It comes from images. It comes from the contours of images. Not a coincidence at all. So our brain filters. It's got preferences. It's got what one would say in technical parlance, affordances. You know, there's like a suggestion that comes from the environment and we pick it up.
And we pick it up also in our individual learning from writing. Do you think that ontogenese is phylogenese and the other side around?
Absolutely. As individuals, we have the same visual perception composition, physiological composition. So we're drawn to the same things. And this is why, I would never call universality into the picture because that is sort of, you know, heuristically, it's a little bit of a reduction of the complexity, like leveling down of the complexity. But there are patterns that the human eye is drawn to, which converge in all instances of drawing things and all instances of writing things. And there were cognitive studies applied to this. This is not my own work, but it's very interesting to see how, if you look at our cultural evolution and the way in which scripts, you know, writing systems evolve, they evolve into the same pattern as, in terms of configuration and frequency of configuration, as the configuration of images as we see them. In other words, it's like letters have developed and have changed into cultural evolution to match physical images around us, so that we will see configurations that are much more frequent than others. For instance, the T, I'm not talking about the letter T in the alphabet, but just the configuration of the two segments attached like this, or the L as a configuration, as a topological sort of, you know, shape, are much, much more frequent in our evolution of scripts than the X or the Y. Because the eye has been accustomed to selecting the things that are easy to recognize and identify because we see them around us. And this is why all writing systems in their evolution match the configuration, the frequency of the configurations of the things that surround us, because they're easy to be recognized by the eye. And this is quite, you know, when I discovered this, when I read about this, I realized how we have an inclination, a propensity to choose and select things. This is not random, in other words. We follow several rules that are tied to our visual perception and the way that we perceive the world, and that we've always perceived the world, which makes me think that there are trajectories and paths to writing specifically in our long history of making symbols that are picked up by every single group or collective set of individuals that chooses things to be transmitted generation by generation for posterity.
I was wondering, your theses are always interconnected to other form of sciences as well as to other research forms like history and so on. Is this an approach you learned to build up, or is it some kind of necessity to have your kind of research done?
I think it's both. To be honest with you, I discovered really early on in my work as a researcher that I needed to be inspired by more than what was a prerogative of my own discipline. And I think researchers have, in a way, should have the curiosity to explore other avenues than the one that is set by tradition and by the history of the discipline, and to branch out and ask questions, big research questions, through different points of view. It wasn't just a physiologic or spontaneous curiosity. It was more of I was drawn to exploring things from different perspectives, to not only branch out, but to extend the possibilities of discourse and trying to answer things from a different perspective, getting off of the beaten path. You know, one would say, think outside the box, but you know, I was pretty much, as we all are as researchers, set into the confines of a given box, and I wanted to break free of that. So in a way, I felt that I should go out of the box, but from the other point of view comes the second part of your question, which is, yes, it is necessary because it works. If you look at it from the point of view of another filter, it may work. And it does. More often than not, if you try to answer a question through the same set of answers, you will never find that very answer that you may find if you look at it from a different discipline. Use a different method. I think it was Einstein who said, if you try to answer the same question, assuming that the answer is always the same, then you're just an idiot. What you need to do, I don't think he said it in such a way, but what you need to do is to think of an answer that is not the answer that has always been applied. And the assumption that we've always done it this way and it doesn't work needs to be turned on its head, really. So looking at different disciplines has always been a challenge, but it's a challenge that's more often than not successful. And, you know, I've concentrated all of my work on understanding writing as a phenomenon. And one is always drawn to think that writing, what is writing? You know, it's an instrument to write down language, to record language, to transmit it. And I think that is such a myopic, short-sighted way of looking at it. Because whether or not you think it's the most important invention of humankind is immaterial to the point of it being a filter through which we see the world. That has to do as much with our linguistic capability and ability as with our cognitive behavior, the way that we think, the way that we represent identity, the way that we have dealt with images, the way that we choose to be creative. It's got to do with anthropology, psychology, cognitive studies, archaeology, history, biology, as much as linguistics, as much as philology. So anything that we make as human beings, that we invent, is a phenomenon that needs to be looked at from so many perspectives than just the one that the tradition has attached to it, if you see what I mean. So that was the need that I felt.
And how many were offended?
Well, you know, you tread on so many feet, right?
Yeah.
Because you enter disciplines that are not your own.
Yeah, and academic is strict.
And academia tends to be a sort of an inside kind of reflective, jargon-induced micro-world, microcosmos that we should all break free from. And there's so much ego in academia, but this is another story.
I think your position, your being brilliant in the books and arguing and describing, shows me a very distinct language you have developed all the time, precisely describing the world around you in different perspective. For instance, simply to win the argument. Because it's kind of, well, say, where's the messy part, you know?
Right.
Because you are, what are disciplines? What is research doing? It's chaos, it's messy, and you have to have a language to structure this kind of chaos and messy beginning. Do you think like this, or do you have a different approach?
I do, unfortunately, because I would love to embrace the chaos that life is all about. But in order to study and analyze, one needs to put order in chaos. And sometimes it's a big task, and perhaps also a presumptuous and arrogant task, because you're imposing an order onto something that may not have it. Especially when you're dealing about phenomena at the very beginning. And interpretation always sneaks into the picture from the back door. In other words, it skews the perception. You know, Umberto Eco, who's a famous semiologist, not only semiologist, but a very good novelist as well.
Indeed.
Wrote that interpretation is the art of lying. Because you're just putting your own point of view into the picture, which is arbitrary, which is subjective, which is never detached from confirmation bias and also many other biases. So you're putting yourself and your ego into the picture, and you're trying to put order into an interpretation that is pretty much all yours. So it's not so much a matter of discerning from the truth, as opposed to discerning the truth from the truth from the lie. It's trying to apply an analysis that presupposes the scientific method, that presupposes the sheer description of the data without any prejudice, without any bias, without any predetermined position or stance, and taking it in as it is, as much as possible. And that, when you're dealing with something that you can't even read, is just 30 feet. And I think, as a researcher, one in any field, anybody that studies, in fact, not just researchers, like students, they have to look at the raw data first before any interpretation can be applied. And, you know, In anything that I've written, be they academic books or popular books, however you want to call them, I've always tried to strive to present the data for what it is without trying to persuade anybody that there is an interpretation lurking into the picture, coming into the picture. And never did I want to assume that I'm interpreting things. In fact, I'm trying to detach the data from any interpretation that other people have put into the picture, saying, oh, it may not be like that, you know? Just step aside, look at it for what it is.
And you're changing the filters.
And I'm changing the filters.
Through art,
but
through anything you read, I think that's your method, is always change the filters and look at it as new.
But shouldn't we all?
If we can, yes. This is an ability.
I don't think so, to be honest. I think there's an obligation. No, I think,
but then it's trained, isn't it?
Oh, goodness. I mean, you know, Freud is looking at us. We're in the right place, actually. You know, I'm in love with what I do, and there's a Freudian obsession attached to it. You know, one is in love with the thing that they love and thinks of it as the most important thing just because they are in love with it. And that skews the picture already, right? So am I objective when I talk about the things that I love? Is anybody objective when they talked about the object of their love? No. But again, I mean, I think we can admit it and acknowledge that we need to step back. We need to step back and look at the things that we're looking at detachedly, as it were, you know, from as much as possible a neutral perspective, and describe them first and analyze them second and try not to interpret them, because interpreting will get you into a can of worms, as it were, you know, a spider's nest. And that is, in principle, a very dangerous thing to do when you study a phenomenon or when you look at data.
Your research projects and your research partners are always arranged in multiple disciplines. What kind of disciplines are there all in? Do you want to be an expert in these disciplines, or do you listen to them, or do you want to have really bottom knowledge of these disciplines, like digital humanities or whatever?
It's both, again. Yeah? I'm a learner. I try to learn as much as I can because I'm curious. If there's one thing that I am arrogant about, is my curiosity. I'm an avid consumer of data. But when I listen to the researchers that I direct, that I lead, I listen philologically, as it were. I try to filter what they show me, because I need to apply a method. So I need to select. And that is, again, a very dangerous process. But I listen. I listen attentively, as I read attentively. I think, again, today we tend to have such a superficial approach to data. We just ingest data instead of absorbing it and digesting it. We just ingest it nervously and without thinking. And I think if you want to do research, if you want to do top research, you need to be very attentive to how you handle data and listen to people that are more expert than you in given disciplines. But, you know, we try and approach the invention of writing from so many disciplines that I have to delegate and rely on other people's expertise. Not a very good delegator, but that's a personal shortcoming of mine. It's a defect. I'm trying to delegate as much as I can, because the mass of work that I have to do forces me to. But I listen to them. I listen to them. I have to listen to them, because I'm not an expert in computer science. I'm learning more and more. I'm not an expert in digital humanities. I'm learning more and more. But I could never replace their expertise. I'm very grateful that I have such a vast array of expertises coming into from amazing researchers that are very patient. And I am very patient towards them too. But I think if you want to do research, you have to open up to other disciplines. Otherwise, there's no point in doing research. That's not research, in my view. Research that is not validated through other disciplines. And, you know, I'm a humanist. I work in human sciences, but I use them as science. I studied them as science. that doesn't make me a scientist. It makes me somebody who applies the scientific method meticulously. Otherwise, I don't get results. So humanities are fantastic, but they need to be co-piloted by other disciplines. That's the future.
And we will stay so. But because I heard a bit of a critics towards the digital realm, we have to deal in research as a whole now. So, yeah, between the cave and the drawings there and the digital, well, let's say analogon then, there's a big difference. And how do you gap this kind of approach it from the subjective to the quantitative data?
I would never say that humanities are subjective as opposed to hard sciences being more objective. Mm. I would never say that. I think humanities can be approached objectively, even though interpretation, as we said before, sneaks into the picture. But there are fantastic researchers in the humanities that use their own discipline only. I'm not one of them. Traditions die hard. Traditions are the most hard-lived thing because they have years and years and years of cogs in the machine that progressively make transmission not only possible but successful. So traditions that have survived for thousands of years, maybe even, or centuries, are very hard to break. But I think right now, today, you know, the world is aflame, but we're living at the cusp of a revolution that we need to take advantage of because it has so many opportunities coming its way. And it's not just AI, artificial intelligence. It's not just that. I think we have in front of our very eyes the potential of a renaissance. And a renaissance means joining different disciplines together to explain things that haven't been explained through the use of one singular individual discipline by itself. In other words, we need a synergy of disciplines in order to understand and come up with answers to big questions. And, you know, my big question is, why does writing look the way that it does? Why does it come so late in our cultural evolution? You know, it's a recent invention in the history of humankind. It dates to 5,000 years ago in the earliest instances, in the earliest attestations, and yet humans have been speaking for 150,000, if not more, years. Why does it come so late? Why such a huge gap? Why does it change so slowly when instead language changes so quickly? How do we build new disciplines through the potential decipherment of ancient scripts that haven't been deciphered yet? What can we do in order to decipher them? I mean, all of these questions need to be answered through the acknowledgement and the recognition of the fact that writing is not just an instrument to record language. It's much more than that. Even though we want to identify ancient languages and, you know, break a new discipline free of the shackles of mystery and enigma and discover ancient languages, if that is the case, if we manage to crack codes from the ancient past. But it's not just a linguistic problem.
May I ask a very naive question? What would be the difference in what came out of your discipline 20 years ago? What were the difference to your research process today? What you can articulate and where are the differences?
Oh, goodness, revolution. I mean,
it is.
It's such a compressed progress. It's quite incredible. Up to 40 years ago, scholars thought that writing had been invented only once in Sumer, in Mesopotamia, about like 5,000 years ago, cuneiform writing. And now we know that there are at least 4 different inventions of writing in the world. One is from Egypt, pretty much contemporary to the Sumer invention. One from China at the end of the Bronze Age, so 1200 BC, about, 3000 and more years ago. One is in Mesoamerica with the Maya. And before the decipherment of Maya, whatever happened there was just art. It wasn't writing, right? So there you go. Again, this problem, when does art become writing? And of course, Mesopotamia. So 4 different inventions of writing in different areas, no influence between them, no transmission, nothing that points in the direction of anything that is not an original invention. These are originally invented writing systems, which means that human beings got to the same results, the same achievement independently. And that tells us a lot about their brains, right? And our cultural evolution. And not only that, but there are 2 instances of scripts, whether they're scripts or not, whether they're writing systems or not, is still, again, under, it's sub judice, it's still debated. But one comes from the Indus Valley, about 4000 BC, 4000 years ago, but pretty much contemporary to Egypt and Mesopotamia. Mm. And another one from Easter Island. And that would be, if it is a writing system, I'm pretty sure it is. That would be the most recent invention of writing in the world because it dates to the 1700s AD. So it's pretty recent. But those 2 scripts are undeciphered. So again, we don't know what languages they recorded, although we have suspicions. But this means that human beings got to writing possibly independently many times in different areas. More than 4 times. But, as many as you want. The point is that we invent and reinvent, but for it to be a successful invention, it needs to be harnessed by an institution that makes it a device that can be transmitted, makes it an instrument that can be transmitted from generation to generation in order to record a specific language. So you need the institution, you need the village, as it were, to grow up to raise up the baby of invention. It takes a village, they say, to raise a child. And it's the same thing here. You need the architecture of social complexity to harness and deliver the successful invention, which means that, potentially there are as many inventions of writing as you want. It's just that, A, we may not be able to decipher them. B, they may not be harnessed by the social complexity of an institution. Call it the city if you want. So you need that entity to harness the possibilities of a successful endeavor. And that happens more rarely. But again, whether the institution harnesses the successful invention or not and makes it a transmittable device or not, is to me marginal. It's epiphenomenal to the fact that cognitively we have that ability. We have all the ingredients in place here in our brain and the possibility of transmuting it and transferring it materially to the physicality of a thing that's recorded on durable material, because that it's incidental again, how many times can an invention be invented on a thing that doesn't resist the forceful, ruinous effect of time?
How much can be forgotten?
How much can be forgotten and how much can be lost? So, again, we're dealing with the potential and the possibility. And I think any human being has the potential and the possibility of inventing a complex thing such as writing. I've read so many times in the scholarly scientific literature, inventing writing is a difficult thing. Is it? it is if you've never been exposed to it. Well, you know, we want to test this. I'm applying. I shouldn't even be saying this, but I'm applying for other research funds. And what I want to do is experiment on this and test people that haven't been exposed to writing. And believe it or not, there are several groups of people that have never been exposed to writing today. It's a difficult ethnographic experiment, but I want to test the possibility of inventing writing. What happens when you invent writing? You know, what is it that you choose to write down? How do you write it down? What shapes do you select? What sounds do you select? All of that has never been done before, to my knowledge. I may be ignorant about this, but I'm, you know, trying to test this is very important because I want to see our cognitive behavior, the cogs of our brain, how they work when that thing is set into motion. I want to test the linguistic trajectory, the linguistic path. What mechanism do we use when we start recording things? Through writing them down, what sounds do we select? How do they work? What principles do we use? All of this is, as far as I know, terra incognita.
But I was wondering, in German context, there's always this big question about vocal alphabets. So the Greeks then did, and their transference were much more easy. They learned the Iliad and the Odyssey on ships, and they sang it. Well, I think it's a German-speaking tradition that we have to tell it like this and have to be in contact with the Greeks about thinking and so on. Is this a perspective you can also approach, or is this something you say is rather nonsense?
No, it doesn't. There's no nonsense about what is received by us, like as a...
It's a thesis, or...
Yeah, there's nothing that's nonsensical about what people assume is... and I don't have a bias against this. I'm not... Maybe I'm slightly skeptical of the assumption, and people are not involved in this, but the assumption itself that the alphabet is the be-all and all of an efficient code. There are complex codes that survived much longer than the alphabet. Think of the Chinese script. It's not ideographic, as people say. It's a logosyllabic writing system, but that's just technicalities. Point being that the institution has made it possible for such a complex script to survive millennia because simply they liked it, because it reflected their own identity in the way that it does, and they wanted it to be preserved. So, and it's much more complex than the alphabet. You know, we live in this Western world that is so imbued and imbibed in the superiority, the supremacy of the alphabetic system, that we do not see that much before writing was invented, sagas were transmitted orally for centuries and centuries, millennia even. And then other writing systems were invented, which are complicated, yes, but they survived, they were used, they were perfect in their own imperfection, because there is no such thing as a writing system that is perfect. Not even the alphabet is perfect. Think of, you know, K and K, for instance, in Italian, or, you know, in several instances in English even, they're completely redundant. You can use either. So
it has to be heard on the ships, like Luf and Le. The difference.
Yeah, exactly. So no writing system is perfect, and any writing system is good for the purposes by which people assumed that it should be used. You choose your own instrument. A group chooses its own instrument and decides to transmit it or tweak it or adapt it or change it. The important thing is that it is appealing to that group. And it works for the purposes for which it was created. And people use it intensively and even redundantly, as we do. You know, any tradition to be successful needs these three very factors at play: appeal, redundancy, and intensity. That's all it takes.
I was always wondering if listening to your own writing can be something else, so that you can read it for yourself, like the vocal alphabet.
Yes.
Because Egyptians with this, was this really read as well, or was it just thoughts?
Right, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, you see, again, tradition plays a huge role in all this. We assume that oral and written are two separate things. There are many writing systems that write down just the very essential thing, you know, just a few elements, and the rest is oral. And people understood. You know, there's this fantastic writing system from China that's called Naxi, that, or Dongba, or Naxi, both terms are used, that writes down recitations and celebrations, let's call them prayers, and writes down just a few elements that need to be written down. The rest is supplied through oral recitation.
Okay.
And more and more, we think, but this is our idea, needs to be tested, that other writing systems have that. They have notation that's written down. Rongo Rongo in Easter Island may be similar to this. But all the additional information is supplied orally.
Okay.
So there is no big divide or a neat, again, messiness, you know. A neat
contains music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And exactly, all the prosody, yeah. Even now, when we write things down, we leave aside so many things that...
It's like the digital age, isn't it?
The digital age records even my, you know, yeah. My hesitation, my, you know, yeah. My, you know, all the things that are not necessary. They're recorded, they're there, they may not be there for posterity. Let's hope that they're not. But every single detail is there. Whereas when writing was first born, think of the proto-cuneiform phase. Mm. You know, this is all technical, but just to give you an example that may be very enlightening, you know, they wrote down lists, but we don't know whether the scribal class supplied much more information than the one that they decided to record, which is very terse and very minimal. So this interface between oral and written is a false divide, yeah, whose boundaries are much blurrier and messier than we want to assume. That we want, you know, human beings need, and so, you know, I'm part of the number of people that want to put order in all of this. But I'm very well aware that putting order in all of this is problematic, just because boundaries are always fuzzy. They're always fuzzy.
So we're losing him a bit.
It makes me think of, I can't believe I'm even quoting him, but I'm, you know, Elon Musk,
yeah,
wrote on his Twitter account a couple of weeks ago. I was struck by this because he wrote, "Don't read the Iliad by Homer. Mm-hmm. Listen to it through an audiobook. It was meant to be heard." It was meant to be heard. It was heard. Definitely. It was heard. And then it was written down. And what we have now is the result of that writing down process. Whereas the reading, the reciting had a whole plethora of information that maybe didn't even end up in the final product, if you see what I mean. Of course, there was music, there was recitation, there was, we think, in the Mycenaean world, there was even a banquet, you know. Mm-hmm. It was all part of a ceremonial process, for sure. So we're missing out a lot of information because writing down things, obviously, is the end result, the culmination of a selection process. Everything is the culmination of a selection process. I if I could, I would apply Darwin to any cultural phenomenon. This is why I believe in cultural evolution. It's the end result, as we see today, of a process. And we live in it now, we're analyzing it now, going backwards, but we can predict where it goes in the future. We can, because we must know. We study what happened backwards. So, and the result of that sifting, that filtering, that selection process is what we can analyze now, synchronically, today, currently.
Would be super to have an audio system in the caves there, because what was sung, what was told to the cave
in Paleolithic times. Yes, I mean, you know, many people think that whatever happened there was part of a religious thing. This has been a long and sort of, you know, long-standing interpretation.
It's more tradition, isn't it? To say everything is religious when we don't know it really exactly.
Yeah, this was my problem, and I wrote about it. And you know, anything that we don't know what it was for must be tied to religion. Function is applied to religion when we don't know what other function it may have had. That to me is, again, heuristically, interpretation wise, is fully loaded. Until you know for sure that that's the case, rest your judgment and rest your case.
Being here in this kind of surrounding, in our podcast studio here that is created by Thomas Hirschhorn, what do you think? It's kind of a cave, written on it in different languages, different colors, different symbols.
Okay, two things here, because one is my personal appreciation of it. And I'm cognitively shocked, if you see what I mean. I have so much information coming my way in a disorderly fashion, because it's meant to be messy, that I am slightly lost at grasping the details. And I'm shocked. It shocks me cognitively.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of it makes me feel slightly disoriented in the same way that a cave with its own particular geomorphology, if you see what I mean, and shape and nooks, crannies and rock art, wood. So the effect is similar, but it makes me, this is the personal assessment, but from a more analytical perspective, it makes me think that we are the society that has more intensively used writing in the history of humanity. We are at this cusp, you know, culmination of the process of using writing so comprehensively, so massively, so even democratically. It's never been used so pervasively before. And this is reflected by the fact that there's, you know, you noticed this before I did, and you said it, there's more writing than image representation. Writing is so incredibly overwhelmingly here that I'm surprised that so few drawings have been made. This surprises me a lot, to be honest, because we are moving towards image making. Image making is becoming part of our communication pattern more forcefully than using writing. It will be so even more intensively in the future. But again, I mean, there are two things that are happening. You know, on the one hand, we have, you know, automated, generated large language models through AI, which will make writing much more massively produced, but not by us. We're delegating a different entity that will write for us in our lieu, as it were. So we will not do it consciously or intentionally anymore. we will devolve all of the unnecessary communication to a machine. So this to me is fantastic. You know, people are very scared of AI. To me, this is fantastic because I will be able to see how we select what we want to write and how we want to do it. And I think we're moving in that direction of sifting through the mass of communication, the mass of information that we will delegate to a machine. And we will concentrate on the things that we really want to communicate. I want to see the choices applied to that. And then we're moving into image making at the same time. So I think it's very exciting to be living at this cusp, at this sort of, you know, a revolutionary transition. But this is a different thing because people are sifting through. They are filtering what they want to write down. Yeah. And that to me is quite an enlightening thing, you know, even though I can't read German. But, the things that I can read are about either writing or thinking.
And you have written something on it as well.
Yes, I mean, Schrift.
Yeah.
When you write things down, you think about writing them, and writing is part of the process. So, you know, I don't want this to sound tautological, as it were. I don't want to say obvious things, but this is a concentrated. This is the sort of, you know, concentrated source of cognitive behavior. It's not just linguistic; it's cognitive, and the colors are just, you know. Again, we always think of writing, and even I define it as such, is, you know, shapes and lines, black on white.
Readable,
black on white.
But and these screens as well, behind you, there are lots of them, and also writing. But here is this iconological writing and picture.
Yes.
More often.
Yes. When we want to express abstraction, we use images much more. But then we need to define them. Again, this ties in with what we were saying before. Images are open to interpretation. So in order to narrow down the message that you want to transmit, you need written words. And this synergy between a little text and the big image, this is something that has always been with us. And this is why comics strips are just so fashionable at the moment. They're so trendy because the image takes center stage. And then you have a little text. That's all you need. You don't need more. We're moving in that direction. Definitely.
But interesting. I have to think this thought and talk about it. Because you said that Umriss from a picture out of the cave,
yes,
is going to be something like a line or a communication element. But now it's working in the other direction, from speech or from a word into a shape again?
Oh, maybe not. I think it's a reciprocal relationship.
Right.
I think the text feeds into the picture as much as the picture feeds into the text. But they need to move together. They've always needed to move together. People think, oh, with emojis, we're going back to the hieroglyphics. No! Emojis have been there for millennia. Millennia. We've always expressed thought and concepts and ideas and words through images. Always.
And will.
And will. That will never leave us. Will writing die? You know, like all human phenomena, they sort of reach that Gaussian, it's a Gaussian kind of curve. We're at the cusp there.
Yeah.
It's bound to go down. Books will always be there, but not in the shape that we're using them. Not at all through the instrument that we have now. Printed paper is a thing of the past, sadly. But we will always be able, through different means, we'll always be able to transmit our thoughts for posterity, in durable, hopefully more durable things than what we're using right now. But we definitely will find ways of innovating the instrument. The thought transmission will always be there. The instrument is bound to change. This is already prehistory.
Yeah, and transformed into writing.
Yes.
All the time. I'm probably cutting this on the basis of writing, not on the basis of the audio.
Right.
So it's transferred into writing, and then you can cancel something, and then it's out of the audio.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, and your own voice is, you can write it in because it's automatically in the machine.
Content will never. Content will always survive. The means by which we transmit them is already changing. It will change. So will writing die? Yes. Sure.
Super ending. Silvia Ferrara, thank you.
Danke.
Die Signation unseres Podcasts stammt von Sebastian Klingowski. Wissenschaftliche Beratung erfahren wir durch Karin Harasser, Andreas Gerlach und Julia Burg-Kaminski. Für die Öffentlichkeitsarbeit zuständig ist Stefanie Obermeier. Technische Unterstützung Max Ott. In der Produktion unterstützen mich Christina Högler, Daniela Losinitzky und Andreas Katan. Die Konzeption des Kulturdenken-Podcasts stammt von Alexander Martosch und mir, Martin Gastaner. Sie finden den Podcast in Ihrer bevorzugten Podcast-Plattform. Wir freuen uns über Ihre Meinung, Kommentare und Fragen und auch Ihre Bewertungen. Auf Wiederhören in der Staffel 3.